Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman. The Big Web Show is brought to you by Audible, the leading provider of audiobooks. Big Web Show listeners can download a free ebook on us and get an extended free trial of the service by going to audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow. That's audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow. You can't tell it, but I had a little dental surgery today. That's why I have to say it again. audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow. And I'll have more to say about that shortly, but let's meet our guest. It's Nick Sherman. Nick Sherman is a Brooklyn-based typographer working with Font Bureau and WebType to promote typefaces for print and digital media. Originally from Cape Cod and Boston, he's also a skateboarder, pizza enthusiast, printer, musician, and classic horror film buff. Musician, I think I had the good fortune to listen to your library once, and it's all just like super hardcore punk. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. I grew up on punk and hardcore and heavy metal.
I mean, stuff that almost that's hard to get to. A lot of the recordings in your library, I thought would be kind of hard to get. Like, would be old vinyl that you ripped or something, or no?
I have done quite a bit of that, but you can find some stuff if you look hard enough.
Now, you are wearing a green hoodie today, which is unusual. Every time I see Nick has like reddish brown hair and red lips and red eyes from working late at night, and he usually wears a red hoodie, which he keeps on top, like in up position. And what's with the green? Is it? It's not St. Patrick's Day.
No, it's just a new sweatshirt I got.
New sweatshirt, okay. Well, it's very handsome. Are we going to see more of this?
I actually wear quite a lot of other colors than red sweatshirts, but for some reason, people remember the red sweatshirt.
Well, red is the most red, black, and white, baby. You know,
yeah.
You know, you used to work with Roger Black, did you not? You have worked with Roger Black.
I still do.
You still do. Well, there you go. And he was.
And it's also the corporate colors of Font Bureau, which is my employer.
Correct, and it's also Coca-Cola, which you are drinking now.
Yeah.
Drink of champions. That's very good. You know, most you're in your 20s, right?
30.
You're 30?
Yeah.
I can't tell anymore. I'm getting so old, everybody looks really young to me. But you're not in the whole health kick that your friends are.
Peers. I would not say that at all.
You're on
candy and pizza and Coca-Cola.
But I don't know how you do it, but do you have like a super fast metabolism?
I must, because I eat a lot of pizza and it hasn't really hit me that hard yet. I feel like one day I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be fat.
35, baby. That's what's going to happen. That's what happened to me.
I got to get all the pizza in that I can before then.
And I didn't know what was happening. I didn't notice for a while. I just kept on working the donuts. But of course, as interesting as your pizza eating habits are, what's even more interesting is that you are working on a series of fonts for the web. Fonts designed to make reading on the web a pleasure and easy. So we've been talking, our community's been talking about web fonts for 10 years. And we've been talking about commercial web fonts for, I guess, 4 or 5 years now, right? Since the launch of Typekit and all the other stuff. So what exactly are the Reading Edge fonts, which that you guys work on? I guess the URL for those following along at home, the URL is fontbureau.com/readingedge. All one word, fontbureau.com/readingedge. So what's the deal with Reading Edge fonts?
So the Reading Edge fonts it's a series of fonts that was started at the Font Bureau where I work. And the basic idea is that when web fonts first became a reality, when people could start to use them, there still weren't that many fonts that were designed specifically for small sizes and for reading, you know, paragraph text.
They were display fonts mostly.
Yeah. And even still, I would say the majority of fonts that you'll find for web use are mostly meant for larger sizes. And you can kind of see this in how people tend to employ web fonts. A lot of times they'll use web fonts for headlines, and then the body type is still Georgia or Verdana or something like that.
Guilty as charged. I do that. And then another thing I've noticed, I think a lot of part of the whole big type craze, right? And I do. My stuff is big type, and a lot of the projects I work on, the type is much bigger than we used to do. Some of that is because of the way we want people to read. Some of that has to do with the high resolution of the monitors now. But I think in part it's because a lot of the web fonts that look really good at display sizes look really crummy at reading sizes. And so we're redefining reading sizes to compensate, right, for the fact that some of our favorite, I won't name names, but some of our very favorite on-screen fonts don't really look good at like 12 pixels or 14 pixels. They're not really readable. They're just blurry. So
great. And that's not necessarily because they're bad fonts or anything. It's
right.
But they weren't designed for that purpose. And so the idea behind the Reading Edge fonts is basically we have these other font series that are already popular in the Font Bureau library. And they may have a display version and a text version. And we figured we would extend them to have some fonts that were designed specifically, you know, from the ground up for use at small sizes on the web or on screens in general.
So what's the difference between Benton Reading Edge and Benton for print? Isn't it all the same outline?
No. The idea is not to, should I say, recreate the same exact look. It's more of a feeling kind of thing. So like if you look at old letterpress typefaces and you compare, say, the 6-point size to the 72-point size, they're pretty far apart.
Right.
The idea is to make more of a cohesive palette of things that work well together but also work well in the situations where they're intended. So, for example...
And we're not used to that because...
Because, I mean, digital type is scalable, and most people, you know, they have one font and they use it for a large number of sizes.
And doesn't that also, when we use SVG, aren't we sort of, SVG can't reconfigure, the outlines don't change subtly as you scale it up and down in SVG, so we're kind of confounding the problem, right?
Right. Though, actually, I was reading something somewhat recently about using media queries with SVG, and I haven't done much experimenting yet, but I want to see what can be done by kind of affecting outlines with media queries and SVG, because you can change SVG to show and hide things depending on, you know, the width of the image or anything like that, same as a web page. I'm not sure if you can affect the outlines or not, but
wow.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, like, you'd have a bunch of different outlines for specific sizes, and you'd hide most of them,
yeah,
and use the media query to show only the appropriate one.
Yeah,
would that be a huge? Wouldn't that make the SVG as big as the font? Then wouldn't you sort of be losing the virtue of,
yeah,
the compactness of SVG?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you're trying to do, I guess. If it's a logo, then it's not really that big of a deal. But if it's like some large infographic, then you might start running into problems. But I'm also interested in seeing what's possible with interpolation with SVG. I feel like SVG is this kind of, it wasn't until somewhat recently that you could use it reliably.
Right.
A lot of people still haven't really jumped into it, myself included. I've done some experiments, but...
Right.
Actually, one of the first experiments I did was to... we did this promotional site for a typeface called Neue Haas Grotesk, and that was the first time I used SVG to do font samples. I figured since we're showing vector fonts, we might as well use a vector format. And that worked out pretty well.
Yeah. Where would we see that?
I believe it's fontbureau.com/NHG.
Wow. Noya Haas. You say Haas Grotesque?
Haas. That was the name. Well, I don't want to give you the full. There's a full history on that site, but basically Haas is the name of the foundry that originally released this typeface, which eventually became
Helvetica. Right. Fontbureau.com/NHG.
Yeah.
And this is all SVG.
Yeah, all the font samples are SVG, so you can zoom way in, and it's still crisp. And then we did some like fallback stuff, so if you're looking in some old version of IE, it just defaults to GIFs or PNGs or something.
Now, I was under the impression with WebType that even with our much higher density displays, that still you kind of want the edge of the type to fall where a pixel falls. You don't want the edge of the type to fall in between pixels, and that's why people set. That's why people change the outlines depending on for different pixel sizes with screen fonts.
Well,
I mean, going back to that's the way it worked in the old days with original screen fonts, right? There was an 11 pixel version, a 12 pixel version, and their outlines were designed to be crisp on a pixel.
And so that's basically.
And haven't
the
we
idea
kind of,
behind yeah. hinting. So hinting, it's hard to give a very succinct description of hinting because it's such a complicated process. But the general idea is that the font would know how many pixels large it was, and then it would kind of warp its outlines in order to get a better result on that pixel grid. But hinting isn't supported on the Mac operating
right.
system.
Because Apple thinks it's not needed, right? Because yeah. why
they
is that?
They developed their own algorithm for rendering that does a pretty good job of figuring out, you know, where to color in pixels and where not to.
So they're smoother on the Mac and crisper in Windows. In good modern Windows.
Yeah, if you're looking in like very old Windows, you might even say that they're even crisper because then it's just black and white.
Right.
But
like an old Mac, like System 7.
Right. And so that's kind of like a taste preference. Some people like the rendering of Windows. Some people like the rendering of Mac. But so the idea of having type that lands exactly on a pixel, like an actual physical pixel in Mac, is almost impossible right now, especially for the web. So,
and especially with people setting type sizes responsively based on M's and percentages, like really screwy percentages. Like, you know, when Ethan Marcotte does responsive design, a font size might have 18 decimal places.
Right.
And it lets the browser calculate that.
Yeah.
So therefore that, you know, it would be hard for that piece of type to know how many pixels it is.
Right. And so now that we have kind of anti-aliased rendering, and as screens are getting higher, the idea of having, you know, each letter fall perfectly on a pixel is, I mean, if you're trying to do that, you're going to drive yourself insane. It's almost
right.
impossible. So the idea with the Reading Edge fonts is to do as much as we can to minimize the problems that come about when you're only dealing with a small number of pixels. So, for example, we'll make some of the features much more sturdy so that, you know, your serif doesn't disappear below a certain size and things like that. And, you know, reducing the contrast between the thick parts and the thin parts of the letter so that they don't fall apart when it gets really small. And there's a whole bunch of other kind of optimizations you can do that it reduces problems when you get at smaller sizes.
And type designers like you have always, I mean, it's a different thing for the screen and it's a different thing for the high resolution screen, but type designers like you have always made optimizations for the defects of the medium, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
Making pieces of a letter empty so that ink could fill in on them on, you know, a certain kind of paper, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, like Bell Centennial is kind of the classic example of that kind of a typeface that was designed for that very specific use of, was actually done for phone books, which are printed very fast and cheap paper.
Yep.
And it bleeds a lot. So Matthew Carter, like, designed these ink traps. And that's not, he didn't invent that. That's been around forever, but it's a very visible example of that.
So if you were to take Bell Centennial the way he actually designed it and look at it on a modern screen or in some other medium, it would look terrible because there would be all these pits in it, right?
Yeah.
Like, well, ink traps.
I actually think it's kind of cool and interesting. To say it's terrible, it's again like
it would look, but it would look very emigre.
It's not how
it would look very 90s, yeah, as opposed to looking really rounded and smooth like we expect it to.
It's not the intended result. And actually, so Christian Schwartz designed a typeface called Amplitude that kind of takes this idea of ink traps and it makes them kind of a stylistic feature of the typeface. And I actually like how it looks a lot.
Cool. Amplitude, where would we find that?
That's the Font Bureau typeface. So it's on the Font Bureau website. But this
Font
idea...
Font Bureau fonts, Amplitude.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. There are the ink traps. Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Listeners, you'll have to go there to see it. But yeah. And I wouldn't have thought, oh, those are the ink traps. But having seen them in the Bell Centennial, I get it.
He's kind of using it as like a stylistic thing. He's taking it to a different place. But yeah, this idea of designing typefaces for very specific uses goes back, you know, it's as old as typography.
Nope.
And that's kind of what Font Bureau has built a business around is instead of... we do have a few typefaces that are... do a lot of heavy lifting and as far as like being able to work in a lot of places, but we really try to focus on developing typefaces that work really well in one place.
And the lead, David Berlow is your director, right?
Yeah, he's one of the co-founders of the company.
But let me ask this. So if I pick Benton Modern or Après, reading edge fonts, and they look great at 12 points, right? Or 12 pixels. They look amazing. Am I going to be able to use them at 18? If I wanted, would I have a problem if I wanted to set my subheads the same size? Or what if I pick this because it looks great at this small size, but I'm making a scalable user interface so that someone can make the type bigger because they have, you know, because they need it for their vision? Or they can make the type bigger because it's a part of, you know, the type is responsive. Does the type still work when it gets really big, or what happens? Do you need to switch to a different font at that point or a different version of Benton?
Well, the idea is that instead of making one typeface that works kind of in a large amount of places, we have these kind of palettes of cohesive faces, like I said. So there's Benton Modern, RE, and then there's normal Benton Modern, and then Benton Modern Display. And if you were doing a responsive design where you wanted to, you know, have things change according to the size, I would definitely encourage people to switch to the different cuts of each face as the size increases. But this is kind of related to one of the articles I wrote for List Apart, in that I always thought it'd be really great if those changes could happen automatically, and
right, if the font would switch to,
like, if the outlines would adjust themselves according to the size or any other number of variables.
Are you talking about font hinting and the future of responsive typography or responsive type? Okay.
Well, I guess I talk about it in the other one too, but. So there's actually this really, really funny thing that not a lot of people know about. And I don't know if you're familiar with multiple master fonts. Have you ever heard of
them? I remember them, sure. I've used them. These were the Adobe fonts where you could squash them and stretch them. And instead of the horrible thing people did when I started doing this in the 90s, people would put a font in Quark Express and then they would stretch it to 140% and it would be horrible. So instead of that, these were fonts that had axes, right? And they were sort of a logic system of fonts, or like a super responsive font, maybe is another way of thinking about it.
That's a good way of thinking about it. Well, it wasn't necessarily responsive in that it would automatically respond. The type designers weren't building that knowledge in, but they were flexible in that you could adjust the weight or the width, or even the kind of optical size, you know.
A designer could do that.
Yeah.
Right? So would you change the X height of a font or something, or no, just make it?
Yeah, I mean, you could have any axis that you wanted. And one of the axes is axes. It was optical size. And so in InDesign, and this, believe it or not, if you can find a multiple master font that has an optical size axis and you install it in your Adobe Fonts folder and you launch the latest version of InDesign, that font will change its outlines according to the size at which it is set.
So you can use multiple master fonts in InDesign now.
Still, yeah.
If you can find them. Does Adobe still sell them?
No, mostly they just sell like flattened versions of them. You know, they would generate an instance that wasn't, you know, flexible. You couldn't adjust the weight and width. And stuff like
were
that
Myriad here. Were Myriad and Minion multiple master fonts originally? There was something special about them.
Myriad and Minion were, there was a whole series of them. And actually a lot of them were really nice designs. And you can still get them and use them fairly well in their kind of static state. But this idea of multiple masters kind of died off. There are many reasons why. Some of it was marketing. Some of it was just people knowing how to do it. Some of it, I think, is just the fact that it was for a static medium. This was before, you know, people using fonts on the web.
This was before Flash, even.
Yeah, I think so.
If they had seen that Flash was coming and that they were going to own it, they probably wouldn't have discontinued making flexible type, because that was like one of the great things about Flash was moving type around and changing size of type and all that stuff.
Yeah. And so, amazingly, this functionality still works in InDesign. I didn't really believe it when I did the test, but...
Is that an Easter egg? I see you've sent me a video that you made showing how this works. I'll just give people your Nick Sherman. It's Flickr. If you're a Flickr member, flickr.com/photos/Nick Sherman. And from there, I don't know really.
Just search for multiple master or something like that.
Multiple master. But this is cool. So this is a little video. There's no sound, is there?
No.
So we're not going to disturb our, okay. So I'm going to try to describe what I'm seeing. Okay.
So this is basically me turning on a preference that says automatically use the right optical size. But this will only work with a multiple master font that has an optical size master.
Benton has sort of a, to me, I always think of this as Clarendon, like this kind of.
There's a lot of similar DNA.
Yeah.
It's kind of a beefy serif.
Yeah. Not a slab serif, because it's a little more curly than that, but kind of. Or an Egyptian serif? I don't know.
Once you start getting into terminology, well, you'll have to have me on another episode just to talk about type terminology.
Okay. Yeah, that would be fun. I bet we'd get some listeners too. People.
But yeah. So the basic thing that this video is showing is that when you turn this preference on and off, it automatically adjusts the outlines according to the multiple master font. So the larger fonts get kind of thinner, hairline strokes, and they get different proportions.
Now, is a more automatic version of that going to happen in the near future? I mean, what is the future of digital type? What's the future of 21st century hinting? Are we going to have fonts that, you know, fonts like Georgia, right, that are smart about exact pixel sizes and are different depending on size? Are all fonts going to have that logic in a very smart, digital-friendly way?
I definitely would not say that all fonts are going to have it. I would love it if there was some kind of, I don't necessarily think multiple master is like we should use multiple master again, but it serves as a good kind of starting point for a new dynamic type format for the web where the outlines aren't static. They're not frozen the way that they are now. And allow either the designer or the type designer to put information in a typeface about which outlines to use or which interpolation to use at certain sizes or different kinds of situations.
How a font doesn't know anything. How does a font know anything? I'm sounding a little bit like my own grandfather, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's...
Well, that's the problem is, I mean, when you're talking about responsive web design, and I showed a slide in the presentation.
Right. I just saw you at Ampersand New York a couple of days ago, right?
Where there's kind of, I call it the glass ceiling, or the glass floor, depending on which side you're standing on, where in responsive web design, everything above the font level, you know, from spans to divs to paragraphs to your body to everything else, it can respond to your media queries. It's flexible and fluid. But everything below the font level, as far as, you know, the X height and the amount of contrast and the stem weight and the length of your descenders, that's all just static and fixed. And there's no way to push information back and forth between the two. And that's what I would love to see.
Is there going to be?
I hope so. It's hard to say what's ever going to happen. A lot of it just depends on, you know, how many people actually try to make it happen. So I've been trying to push this idea, or at least get people starting to think about this, even just in very basic ways, like what you guys did on a list apart with, you know, switching to Georgia condensed.
Right. So for listeners, when you are a list apart, when you look at it on the phone, it goes from Georgia Pro to Georgia Pro condensed. And if you turn it sideways again, if you go from portrait to landscape, then it goes back to non-condensed. And it's really subtle. People don't notice it.
Right.
Maybe a couple of designers have obviously said stuff about it, but mostly it's just a nice reading experience, and you get to have a better reading experience without thinking about it much. You said hinting is to fonts what responsive layout is to websites.
Yeah. And that's basically the idea that hinting, in essence, is a font. And this only, you know, hinting only works in Windows or, you know, places that support hinting. It's not universal. And the idea is the font can know how many pixels it's being rendered in. It doesn't necessarily know how big the pixels are, but it can adjust accordingly. So it does a media query, essentially, on its rendering size, and then adjusts accordingly. And that's pretty much the same idea as responsive layout, doing a media query and adjusting accordingly. But this is something that existed long before responsive design. It existed even before the web. I mean, hinting was originally used for...
TrueType?
No, for low-resolution printers.
Okay.
So
in the early 90s?
This is even back in the 80s.
Okay.
And the idea was that the printer, if it was really low resolution, you know, if one stem was one pixel wider than it should have been, or I should say one, you know, printer dot wider than it should have been, then it would mess up how the type looks. So that's where you would first start seeing hinting being used.
I want to hear so much more about this and about your experiments, the experiments you've been doing, and pizza and skateboards. But we have to take a little commercial break, so hang out for a second, Nick and listeners. Stay with me. The Big Web Show is sponsored in part by Audible, the leading provider of downloadable audiobooks. And we have a special offer exclusively for Big Web Show listeners. Audible offers 100,000 books covering virtually every genre. If you want to listen to a book, Audible has it. Listen to audiobooks anytime, anywhere. iPhones, iPads, computers, Kindles, whatever. Here's the best part. Audible is offering Big Web Show listeners a free audiobook along with a 30-day trial. Go to audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow to take advantage of this special offer. And if you do that, you'll not only get a chance to check out a great service, but you'll support our show as well, because your support for our sponsors keeps us on the air, or whatever you call digital air. Here's a book your ears might love. The Design of Everyday Things by Don Norman is on audible.com. So first, businesses discovered quality as a key competitive edge. That seems like a strange thing to discover. They discovered quality. Hey, let's stop making crap. Let's make something good and see if that gives us a competitive edge. Next came science. Now Donald Norman, well, not now, but when this was written, Donald Norman, former director of the Institute for Cognitive Science at the University of California, reveals how smart design is the new frontier. The Design of Everyday Things is a powerful primer on how and why some products satisfy customers while others only frustrate them. Enjoy The Design of Everyday Things, narrated by Peter Burkrot and written by the great Don Norman, on audible.com, on us. Once again, get your free audiobook and kick off your free trial at audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow. But wait, there's more. Big Web Show is also sponsored by Igloo. Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. Listeners of the Big Web Show should go to igloosoftware.com/big so Igloo knows we sent you, because that will help us stay on the air. You can share content, because it's a good service. You can share content quickly with built-in apps, blogs, calendars, file sharing forums, Twitter-like microblogs, and wikis. Everything is social. You can comment on any kind of content, at mention your coworkers, follow content for updates, and use tags to group things around the way you work. You can add on rooms like mini igloos for each of your teams to work in. It's easy. The whole thing is, get this, it's drag and drop, features responsive design, and uses beautiful fonts from Typekit. Your Igloo has enterprise-grade security, and you can start using it right away. It's free to use with up to 10 people. Absolutely free. 9 people? Free. 10 people? Free. And when your Igloo grows, it's only $12 per person per month. So if nothing else, just check out the website to see their genuinely funny videos about the service. Go to igloosoftware.com/big to start building your Igloo. That's igloosoftware.com/big. Okay. And speaking of igloos, it has been very cold in New York, where we are both situated, but today is a warm spring-like day, which is nice. And yet we're still both wearing hoodies, which is perplexing. Nick, you recently, at Ampersand New York, you demonstrated something you invented called the Size Calculator, a web application designed to bring screen design a capability that print has had for 500 years. Right? The ability to print something at actual size.
Well, more or less. It's mostly to, well, first of all, to calculate the numbers that, you know, the relationship between viewing distance, physical size, and then the kind of perceived size in an angle, a unit of angle. And this is something that's been around, I mean, it's probably been around since before typography, even, this idea of, you know, having something look bigger when it's closer to your face. It's pretty basic,
right?
human nature, but
like a fist.
Yeah. That's a good thing to keep away from your face. But what I wanted to do, was to figure out what size I would have to set something if it was 100 feet away from me to make it have the same visual size, perceived size, as you know, say 12-point type that was only 15 inches from my face.
So that what? Why would you want to do that?
Because that's essentially the thing that matters the most when you're talking about type size. And so a lot of times when people say, like, oh, the font's too big on this website, it's like, well, according to what? You know, if you're sitting with your face right up against the screen, maybe it's too big. But if you're standing 10 feet away or 100 yards away or 100 light years away, it's definitely not too big. But this is something that, I mean, you can't really specify type in arc minutes or degrees or anything anywhere and have it kind of actively adjust according to how far away the viewer is. But it's something that I've always been interested in. And it's definitely relevant when you start talking about readability and legibility and just plain old optics of how type works with your eye.
So if you have a set of known screens, like you're going to be designing something for a 200 square foot screen at an auditorium, mm-hmm. and an iPad, a second generation iPad.
Yeah.
You could make the type exactly the same on both or you could make something exactly the same on both things and be absolutely confident that it will map one to one. That's what you're talking about.
In theory, yes.
Yes.
There are problems, though, with that statement because you would then have to know the exact resolution and size of the screens, which, you know, with responsive web design, you can't really do that yet. And that's a problem, if you ask me.
Well, we've talked about this a little bit, but I initially would have agreed with you and said, yeah, that's a terrible problem, because I really come from a fixed size place in my head. That's how I understand the world. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me the longer I've thought about responsive design and seen what different people are doing with it and talked to Ethan Marcotte, it seems to me like it's designed for ebb and flow. It's not designed to fight against all these unknowns. It's designed to embrace them. It's designed to reconceptualize design as not here's my grid and this goes here and this goes here, but here's this fluid, silly putty universe, and I'm going to make a coherent design that works no matter what.
Right.
Does that make sense?
And I think this is something that a lot of people, when you start talking about absolute physical size, people think, oh, that's just someone who's used to working in the print world and they're trying to like hold as tightly as they can to static, fixed absolute sizes. And that's not at all what I'm trying to do.
Right.
My point is that if you can know the absolute size of the screen that you're going to be working on, you can inform your responsive design accordingly. Like, so as you said, if say you know the number of pixels that are going to be used for this presentation, maybe it's a headline, it's like you can assume, you know, it will probably be about this big, but there's no way to know for sure, like, whether it's going to be on a gigantic billboard size screen where the pixels are 1 inch each, or, you know, on an iPhone where the pixels are, you know, a fraction of an inch or a centimeter. And so the idea is less to set one static size and have it be the same everywhere, but more to test what the sizes are that you're working within and adjust your design accordingly. So for example, with type, even if you have the same visual size, there are other things that factor in with optics about how light bounces around inside your eye that affect, that are an effect of the physical size. So just because the type might look the same size from 12 feet and from 12 inches doesn't necessarily mean that I want the type to be exactly the same.
I would have a very different experience, even if the type were optically the same size. If I'm looking at a sheet of paper that's 12 inches from me, and I'm looking at a screen that's 200 feet from me.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Hobie von Hoos is an Elista Part reader who was reading about, was reading about his size calculator, and he said, "The sad thing is this tool would be much more useful if devices, mainly Android, didn't lie about their resolution."
Yes.
There's also Apple devices that lie about their resolution, to be fair. The iPad
Pretty Mini. Pretty much every device lies about its resolution. And that's...
Every device lies about its resolution?
Pretty much. I mean, if you're talking about DPI, as in actual dots per inch or pixels per inch, or... I mean, even just the idea of an inch. Like, I did this this challenge on Twitter. I said, if anyone can render a $1 bill on a web page without knowing exactly what the device is ahead of time and have it, like, you know, so I can hold the dollar bill up to it and it's exact size, I'll give you $100.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
Unless by fluke it worked for one person, by accident on one instance.
Yeah.
That is impossible.
I'm sure there's cases where like it magically lines up, but for the most part, any resolution that you're getting from your media queries is wrong.
Well, and when I look at when I'm in Photoshop and I'm saying I want to see this actual size, it never looks actual. What then they say, we're going to show it to you actual size. It never actually is. I don't even know what that means anymore.
And this is partially, I mean, there are historical reasons why a pixel somehow became not a pixel anymore.
Well, they used to describe the original definition of a pixel by the W3C in like HTML 2.0 or in CSS 1 was the arm length of the, it was like the smallest perceivable dot from by a person with average eyesight holding the screen at arm's length away of an average height person, whatever that means. I mean, it was like, you know, I should look it up exactly, but it was something like that screwy. It was like, just the smallest dot on the screen. It was as seen by Hokum Lee, if he puts his hand in front of this particular monitor on, you know, on a Thursday.
Well, actually, I don't know if it was the original one, but at one point in the CSS spec, a pixel was related to an actual physical unit. The spec now explains that it was changed because I can give you an exact quote now.
Are we talking about a reference pixel, the visual angle of one pixel on a device with a pixel density of 96 dpi and a distance from the reader's length of an arm from the reader of an arm's length? For a nominal arm's length of 28 inches, the visual angle is therefore about 0.0213 degrees. I don't know. I forgot what a pixel is. And they go on. There's more. So and I know they're smarter than me, but I'm so confused by this.
Which version of the spec you're looking at? There's a note that explains that in previous versions of CSS, the pixel unit and the physical units were not related by a fixed ratio. The physical units were always tied to their physical measurements, while the pixel unit would vary to most closely match the reference pixel. And then it goes on to explain.
Yeah, it was never an absolute unit. Right. A pixel was, you'd think it was, but it wasn't. An inch was an absolute unit, even though it's not really an inch. A centimeter was an absolute unit, even though it's not really a centimeter in the W3C, right? None of those things are real.
And the fact that they call them those, I mean, I'm completely all for the idea of kind of a relative unit of scale, but the idea that they're calling it an inch and a centimeter and everything seems completely backwards. And I understand why that happens. They
explain it to me. Explain it to me, because I don't understand why it happens.
So this is straight from the spec, and this is a quote. It says, The change was made because too much existing content relies on the assumption of 96 DPI.
Right.
And breaking that assumption breaks the content. And that's completely true. If they just change the spec and all of a sudden an inch actually meets an inch, that all the stuff that was made before won't work anymore.
But it was a major achievement to get everything to that 96 PPI. Way before, when you were a child, a guy, Todd Farner, convinced the browser makers and Mac and Windows, everybody, to go with 96 PPI and 16 pixels as 12 points, which basically convinced everyone that. So, right, the Mac was always 72 PPI, and that was because Mac was sort of like influenced by graphic design.
Yeah,
and Windows was 96 PPI. I don't know why. Maybe it was easier for hardware or it was random. I don't know. But since there were many more Windows users at that time, Todd said, you know, people used to do things like, well, we have to have relative sizing. And then they would make type that you couldn't read on a Mac because it was sized relative to that. So it was the standardization on that was kind of that was a nice thing at the time. I mean, that was a great thing at the time.
And I completely see how there were practical reasons for doing it. The problem is that since then, there hasn't been anything introduced to give us what we actually really want, which is a unit that's tied to a physical inch or a physical pixel or something like that. So as I said in my talk last weekend, like, if you're going to fix something, definitely avoid breaking other things when you fix it.
Right.
But still, you should fix it. You should offer a solution. And that still has not yet happened. The interesting part about this is when you do a media query for resolution, you don't get the actual result. But there are many display devices that report their actual resolution and size to the operating system. But you just can't access that. So if you look
but
up
not to
thing,
the browser.
Definitely not to the browser. If
so
you look
the operating
up this,
system knows, but the browser doesn't know. And the browser's the browser's acting on the media query, but it's being sent false information. And the operating system knows the information is false.
They may or may not even look at it. So if you look up this thing called EDID, it's a data structure that basically tells software information about the physical parameters of a display device. And there are a lot of display devices that support this. The problem is there's really no way you can do a whole lot with it yet. I actually just learned a couple weeks ago, I was talking to some guys from Microsoft. Apparently in Windows 8, if you're making a web app, but not a website. It has to be like still within the confines of Windows 8. Mm-hmm. You can apparently access this. There's something called like raw DPI or something, JavaScript query. But you can't make any use of that from a website yet or in the foreseeable future. That's kind of like the light at the end of the tunnel for me. Is that there's like a speck of hope that at some point, we'll
a
be able
speck
to get
of hope.
It's like a pixel, a reference pixel of light at the end of the tunnel.
Very nice.
Where we'll be able to get information about the physical resolution and size of whatever display device we're working with.
So this is not a W3C standard, but it is a Video Electronics Standards Association VESA standard, EDID. You can read a lot more about it on Wikipedia, obviously. Just type EDID. And Google will take you there.
Yeah.
And so you foresee a day when our media queries will be able to access this kind of information?
Yeah. And so I do this kind of stunt in my talk where I can actually render a dollar bill at the actual size because I know ahead of time what the size of the screen is.
Right.
And people always really enjoy that. They think it's humorous and kind of cool, but when you think about it, it's very basic math. That it's not very impressive to be able to do that. But people are so used to not being able to do that, that it's like a magic thing to them.
Well, we work with so many unknowns.
Yeah.
Right. This is as if you had someone in the audience and you know what's in their wallet. You're a magician right. with one person in the audience. And you go, and they're going, wow, he knows what's in that guy's wallet. Yeah, because he's working with that guy. I mean, yeah.
And so this idea of getting the actual physical dimensions of something, it's basically just adding, removing one of the other unknowns from when you're the process of responsive web design.
When you go to size calculator.
Well, the tricky thing about size calculator.
Sizecalc.com for listeners. Sizecalc.com.
Under the current situation, because you can't know the actual physical size of things, this is really only kind of to get you thinking about it. It's not like you can take this information and copy and paste it into your CSS and have it work the way you would expect it to work.
I want to know what's going on in that fellow's pants. What? Did you draw the guy?
No, this is from some... I believe it's an open source like silhouette vector pack.
It's hilarious. It feels very indie film to me, just the silhouette that you have here. So it's from an open source pack. And you got... you have sent me a file, but I don't think... is there a Dropbox folder where you're publicly sharing something? No.
No. Actually, I'm not sure if the outline was open source or it was just open for any use for free. I don't know what the rules are about editing it and stuff like that. But I wanted to put my own silhouette in there, but I just never got around to drawing myself.
It could almost be you. But I just... Are those his hands in his pockets? What's going on there? There's a strange... Am I bulge. Right?
Yeah, he's got a bulge.
He's got a bulge like...
He's looking at that wonderful typeface by Cyrus Sexman.
That must be it, by Cyrus Sexman?
Highsmith.
Highsmith, sorry. Oh, Cyrus Highsmith. But it just... Remember in A Clockwork Orange, they had those cod pieces? That's what this looks like. So it's like a typical... It's very subversive and disturbing that there's this... Also, I'm a little so I'm going to recommend sizecalc.com. There's more about it in the Elistapart blog. Nick Sherman, we're starting to run out of time. So Nick Sherman is followed by Eric Vorz. And am I saying that right? Vorhees?
Yeah. Well, I think. I don't know. You'd have to ask him. But I think I would say it Vorhees.
Vorhees.
But
Mark Simonson. All the type designers. His type design brings all the boys to the yard. Nick Sherman is Nick Sherman at Twitter and nicksherman.com. And he is a columnist for Elistapart. You will find his work at Font Bureau and WebType. We haven't really talked about WoodTyper or fonts in use or pizza rules or specimenism or your photo journal. You have, and we haven't talked about your work at the Type Directors Club. Or the Hamilton Wood Type and Printing Museum. Good Lord. Do you ever sleep?
Not a whole lot.
We're going to have you come back to talk about it. I got to say, Fonts in Use is just the most amazing website. We're not talking about it now because we're out of time, but fontsinuse.com is just a wonderful place where you're looking at something going, now, what is that? And just there... There are essays, really, little miniature essays about what was used and why. Sometimes there are essays. Sometimes yeah. It's, yeah.
And the general idea is to have a collection of examples of specific fonts in use for different, you know, industries or formats. And then we have kind of an accompanying blog where there are some things where we go really deep into it and explain specifics.
You recognized the typefaces used in the poster for TNT Jackson. Jackson, yeah. I think that's probably my favorite thing right there. A 1970s blaxploitation film, spine-shattering, bone-blasting, she's a one-mama massacre squad. TNT Jackson, she'll put you in traction. And you like anyone would looking at this poster, you went, oh, Kaufman, Antique Olive and City. Very nice.
Yeah, we have a whole blaxploitation tag on Fonts and Use that has Shaft and all kinds of other great stuff.
And what's fontsanduse.com? Well, we're going to have you back to talk about it because it's amazing and super fun. So I advise everyone who likes type, and if you don't like type, you're not even listening at this point. But if you like type, check out fontsanduse.com, nicksherman.com, Nick Sherman on Twitter. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks, everybody. See you on the next Big Web Show.